Welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 486 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. This is going to be series 103. Let's get right to it. What if they give you a question about a 79-year-old female? They tell you that she's brought to the office because she recently passed out. And you're told that she has this ejection murmur at the right upper sternal border. And then you're told what is the next best step in diagnosis. Obviously, without thinking too hard about this, sounds like this person has aortic stenosis. And you may be like, Divine, you just said the person has an ejection murmur. You didn't even tell us if it was systolic or diastolic. What's going on here? Well, the thing is, this question gave you too many patterns to make you... It doesn't seem very wise to neglect aortic stenosis. First, it's an old person. We say the person had a syncopal episode. Aortic stenosis, classically on the USMLEs, when it causes symptoms, it's usually going to be syncope, or gonna be like anginal symptoms. So we see the person is really old. You see a really old person with like an ejection murmur, it's probably gonna be aortic stenosis, right? And we know that aortic stenosis, again, it's a systolic ejection murmur. And typically we're gonna hear it in the right upper sternal border, which makes sense, right? If you analyze the direction of flow, the aorta brings blood from the left ventricle. And remember that the left ventricle is sort of kind of on the left side of the body. As blood is leaving the left ventricle and going into the arch, it takes off towards the right. It's like rightward oriented. So if you have a stenosis of the aortic valve, you will hear a rightward oriented systolic ejection murmur. That's why it's heard best at the right upper sternal border. If you really map out the anatomy of the heart, you'll see it makes a ton of sense. Now, what are some other things you may see with an aortic stenosis question before we talk about the management and workup and whatnot, right? Again, first things first, it's a systolic ejection murmur, right? Because you're going to feel the effects when you're trying to eject blood from the left ventricle. So that's in systole. So it's a systolic ejection murmur. And many times they'll tell you that the person's carotid pulses are diminished. So when you try to feel their carotid pulses, it'll be really, really hard to feel. They're going to be delayed. They're going to be diminished, right? Because blood is having a lot of trouble getting out of the left ventricle. So that blood is not really going into the aorta and subsequently not into the carotid. So they're going to have like a delayed, diminished carotid pulses. And you may also notice that they may have concentric hypertrophy of the left ventricle. So because it's so hard for blood to leave the left ventricle through the aorta, the left ventricle gets big and beefy to be able to generate enough force to get blood out. So you have concentric hypertrophy where you lay down your sarcomeres in parallel. So you're ultimately going to develop like diastolic heart failure because basically the cavity size of your left ventricle gets smaller just because of all the muscle in the way. Okay. So what are you going to do? Well, obviously you're going to do some kind of echocardiography. Whenever a person has a murmur that is symptomatic, you typically have to get some kind of echocardiogram. You may wonder, Divine, what kind of echocardiogram do we get? Well, typically, we want to get a TTE, a transthoracic echocardiogram, transthoracic echocardiogram, right? And many times that, you know, echo is going to show you the valvular issue. So in this case, person is going to be, you're going to see the aortic stenosis. And many times when we're managing aortic stenosis, are you going to check the valve area? You're going to check the valve area. So how in the world do we manage aortic stenosis? Well, obviously, if the person doesn't have symptoms, you don't usually have to do anything. But if they have symptoms, so like say, for example, they have heart failure symptoms. So let's say the ejection fraction is less than 50%. And I've talked about how you can get to heart failure with that. Or they have angina, or they're having syncopal episodes. You have to manage it. Another weird detail you may see is the valve area, although this one is a little lower yield. But if the valve area is less than 1 cm², that's also kind of worrisome. In those circumstances, you're going to make sure you go ahead and replace the valve, right? Because remember, in aortic stenosis, the problem is you have calcification of the valve. So it's most times you just have to go ahead and change out the valve. Just go ahead and do a valve or replacement. Because again, remember the pathophase phase is calcification. And I think I've said this in another podcast, but just bears repetition. Whenever you see a person having aortic stenosis, in their late 40s, 50s, many times you're thinking about a bicuspid aortic valve. Remember, bicuspid aortic valve, we tend to find that in Turner syndrome. Basically, you have, because normally the aortic valve has three cusps, but if you have a bicuspid valve, you now have two cusps. I just like to think of it as like two residents doing the job of three. Those two residents are going to burn out very quickly. So same thing happens with a bicuspid aortic valve. The calcification that happens in aortic stenosis is just going to be accelerated in a person that has a bicuspid valve, because two cusps are doing the job of three cusps. So the calcification will be accelerated, it'll be pronounced, and the person is going to get in a lot of trouble. Person's going to get in a lot of trouble. Now, one thing that I just maybe want to throw in here, because our friends at the USMLEs, they're pretty smart. They're pretty smart. So they can make this a physiology question and make a bunch of arrows. And that can really mess a person up. So let's not just talk about aortic stenosis from the classic stuff everyone knows, but let's maybe discuss a few arrows with aortic stenosis. So first things first, what's going to happen to your cardiac output when you have aortic stenosis? Well, obviously your cardiac output is going to be diminished, because if blood is not coming out of the left ventricle adequately, then blood is not going into the aorta. Right? Your cardiac output is going to get crushed. Your cardiac output is definitely going to get crushed. Okay. Now, what happens to the diameter of the area of the aortic valve? Well, it's going to go down. It's going to go down, right? Because that's stenosis. That's why it's called stenosis. That means there's a narrowing, right? So they can frame this in many different ways. They can frame it as the radius. The radius is going to be diminished, right? Or the diameter is going to be diminished, or the valve area is going to be diminished, right? In fact, one of the ways we define aortic stenosis is, say, for example, the person has a valve area of less than 1 cm², that's taken as severe aortic stenosis. We need to do something in that circumstance, right? Now, let me ask you this. What's going to happen to the velocity of the blood coming through the aorta? What's going to happen to the velocity of blood coming through the aorta? Again, these, I'm telling you, these can easily be arrow questions on your exams. I hope you're telling me that, wow, Divine, is going to increase. It's going to increase. Maybe like, Divine, can you kind of explain this? Honestly, the easiest way to explain this to you is to essentially give you the example of a garden hose. And then maybe I'll try to use like an actual physics formula to explain it, although I don't think the physics formula is particularly relevant here. But basically, if you have a garden hose, you know, water is flowing, coming out of said garden hose. If you want the water to be more targeted and to not just targeted, but to come out with greater speed, what do? Just kind of put your finger at the tip of the hose, cover up some of the area. As you cover up some of the area, the velocity of the water coming out of said garden hose goes up quite significantly. So that's the same thing that happens in aortic stenosis. Basically, the blood that's coming out of your left ventricle starts coming out with higher speed because you've had this progressive narrowing of the lumen of the aortic valve. So the blood coming through the aortic valve, the velocity is going to go up. Again, that's pretty high yield to know. In fact, that's, believe it or not, one of the criteria that's also used to manage aortic stenosis. We say, oh, wow, severe aortic stenosis is if your aortic valve, you know, the blood coming through, the velocity is like over 4 m/s. Remember, velocity is measured in meters per second. So, you know, in those circumstances, that's not good, right? It just tells you that, man, this narrowing is too bad. And these are all things we can easily track. We can easily track this with imaging. So since it's something that's easily trackable, you can use it as a guide as to, do I got to manage this person or not? Again, honestly, these specific criteria for valve area less than this, velocity greater than that, you don't really need to know that, honestly. That's more for like internal medicine boards. But understanding the concept is very, very helpful. And then another thing that may also help you is just kind of keeping in mind, they may ask you, oh, what will happen to the transvalvular gradient? Transvalvular gradient. Well, the transvalvular gradient, I would hope you're saying, Divine, is going to go up. So let me explain what in the world is the transvalvular gradient. Well, the transvalvular gradient is basically the pressure difference between the left ventricle and just after the aortic valve. That's the easy way to think about this. That's the rough, easy way to think about this. Transvalvular gradient, right? Look at the name, transvalvular. That means it's the gradient. So that means the difference in pressure between across the valve. So just before you hit said valve, aka the left ventricle, and after you traverse said valve, you know, just distal to the aortic valve itself, the transvalvular gradient is going to go up. Again, why is that? Well, again, you have a stenotic valve. So because you have a stenotic valve, it's really hard for blood to leave the left ventricle. So the blood in the left ventricle, for it to try to come out, is going to be pushed with such great force, such great pressure. So the pressure inside the left ventricle is going to go up a lot, right? But since almost like a little trickle of blood is coming out each time from the aortic valve, that blood coming out from the other side has very low pressure. Right? It has very low pressure on the other side of the problem, right? So before the problem, I just like to think of aortic stenosis as a log jam, as a traffic jam, right? Think about it, right? For those that live in New York or California, probably have a very intimate knowledge of stuff like this. But think of the stenotic aortic valve as like a semi that has tipped over on the highway. Before the truck that has tipped over on the highway, you know, there's this huge traffic jam. But boom, the moment you go past that truck, you're like, gee, this highway looks so clear and clean because there's this huge backup, right? So basically, the pressures proximal to the stenosis are high. The pressures distal to the stenosis are low. So that's why the transvalvular gradient goes up. In fact, as aortic stenosis gets more severe, the transvalvular gradient should go up. Again, I know some of you may not have heard of aortic stenosis in this light, but I promise you, this is a light you want to understand. Even for, this is a step two, step three podcast. But honestly, even people that are taking step one, these are principles you want to make sure you understand, because they can easily make these things arrows. That's honestly the truth. That's honestly the truth. Okay. So maybe one thing I think that may be helpful is talking about some buzzwords related to these valvular problems. The buzzwords I'm just going to mention is this. Number one, remember I said aortic stenosis is the calcification of the valve that causes the problem. Number two, when a person has mitral valve prolapse, the big buzzword you want to make sure you know is that this person has a myxomatous degeneration of the valve. And then another thing to kind of keep in mind is if a person has aortic dissection, right? Remember, we'll see aortic dissection, a bunch of disorders like Ehlers-Danlos, Marfan's, aortitis with tertiary syphilis. The pathophase there in those circumstances typically is going to be The pathophase usually is going to be a person that has a cystic medial necrosis. So the media of the artery necroses or degenerates. So it's easy for blood to just rip through that intima and into the media and cause a lot of problems, right? And I guess if you're comparing aortic stenosis to mitral stenosis, because many times if they're testing valvular issues, they usually focus on the mitral and aortic valves. If you're looking at mitral stenosis, obviously the big message there is typically, people that have mitral stenosis, the murmur is going to be heard at the apex, and you're going to hear an opening snap. It's going to be a diastolic murmur at the apex with an opening snap. So why is it a diastolic murmur? Well, it's a diastolic murmur because you feel the effect when blood is trying to go from the left atrium to the left ventricle. Well, if blood is filling the left ventricle, that's clearly diastole. So it's a diastolic murmur with an opening snap. And it's heard best at the apex. The apex is where you hear a lot of mitral murmurs pretty well. And the thing is, there are some salient differences. And obviously, you're going to do an echocardiogram. Right? If a person is symptomatic, you're going to do an echocardiogram. Now, the thing is, the management of mitral stenosis is a little different compared to aortic stenosis. But the thing is, there's lots of very good integrations you can make here. So it's something I would kind of know and make sure you understand. So again, if a person has mitral stenosis and they have no symptoms, you don't have to do much of any treatment. But if they're symptomatic, right? So let's say they're having heart failure symptoms, they're becoming short of breath, they're becoming dyspneic, right? In those circumstances, you want to do something called a valvuloplasty, a valvuloplasty. valvuloplasty, a valvuloplasty, a valvuloplasty, not necessarily a replacement. Don't get me wrong, can you replace the mitral valve? You absolutely can. But I will say, on, for purposes of the USMLE exams, it makes more sense to do valvuloplasty. You know, every now and then we see comingeurotomy, but most times we do valvuloplasties. Do the valvuloplasty, that's preferred just generally to a mitral valve replacement, because the valvuloplasty works extremely well. Although, one classic, because in a valvuloplasty, essentially, what you're trying to do is basically dilate the valve with a balloon. It works pretty well. You know, the outcomes are pretty great, even for years after said procedure. But one thing our friends at the USMLE can throw you away on an exam, or this is something I can easily see making its way to a surgery shelf exam, is what is like the acute complication of this management step of this valvuloplasty. And the big thing I want to think about is mitral regurg. The thing is, it's one of these things that is easily testable because it almost makes no sense, but it actually makes a lot of sense when you think about it. But basically, think of acute mitral regurg. Why? Well, because if you're dilating a valve that is stenosed, well, the body is used to the valve being stenosed, right? Well, that's one of the wonderful things about the body. The body is very good at compensating. But then if the body notices that, gee, what happened? Like, how did this thing that was stenosed suddenly become like, all of a sudden over like a few minutes or a few hours, just become wider? Well, the body's going to be like, ah, this is crazy. And you're going to have a lot of regurg across that newly dilated valve. But over time, it's going to resolve. It's not going to be a big deal, right? So valvuloplasty is preferred to mitral valve replacement for mitral stenosis. And the big complication of valvuloplasty is acute mitral regurgitation. That's kind of like the big complication you want to know for your exam. And then people that have mitral stenosis, you generally want to give those people, especially if they get treated, right? Mitral people that have mitral stenosis that get treatment, they deserve rheumatic fever prophylaxis. Many times you're going to be on penicillin for about a month or thereabouts. Remember, penicillin is actually pretty good for treating rheumatic fever. Although if you have a penicillin allergy, you may have to consider other medications. And then remember that people that have mitral stenosis, especially if it has become symptomatic, chances are pretty good that they have AFib, right? Remember, the biggest risk factor for AFib is mitral stenosis, because if you have a stenosed mitral valve, your left atrium has to get very strong, has to get big and beefy, has to dilate to get blood through said mitral valve. So the thing that's going to happen is you can develop AFib. You can develop AFib. Remember that irregularly regular murmur. So those people's AFib has to be managed. Many times they're going to be on warfarin, you know, so they don't get a stroke. And they're also going to be on some kind of drug like, you know, like a beta blocker or some kind of non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like verapamil or diltiazem, right? And again, if they've started developing heart failure from their mitral stenosis, right, you're going to go ahead and manage it. So, you know, beta blockers, remember, beta blockers do improve survival in heart failure. So you're going to put them on a beta blocker. And obviously, if you have volume overload from that, you can put them on a diuretic as well. And again, don't forget, always give them that stroke prophylaxis. Always give them that stroke prophylaxis. If a person has mitral stenosis, they got to get stroke prophylaxis. Especially if they have AFib. That's kind of like the big thing. Usually on the exams, when they give a person mitral stenosis, person's going to have AFib concurrently. In those circumstances, put the person on prophylaxis. Use warfarin. You're like, oh, Divine, can't you use a DOAC or a NOAC or whatever? No. Whenever a person has AFib and mitral stenosis, pretty much your only option is warfarin in terms of anticoagulation for those people on the USMLE exams. It's very important. Again, I know some of the things I'm saying in this podcast kind of sound a little off-putting, but I promise you these things are very, very high yield to know for your test. So I think I'm going to go ahead and pause here since this is a rapid review. Again, I promise you, please make sure you listen to these things. If you don't understand a lot of the physiology I was explaining, go back and listen to this stuff. This stuff will really, really help you on your exams. I promise you that. Again, if you're taking step 2 or step 3, Step one, I have a bunch of classes coming up, starting tomorrow. That's Thursday. I have a test taking class for step one to step three on Thursday, biostats class on Friday that runs for 4 hours, social sciences and ethics and QI and healthcare systems class on Saturday runs for 5 hours, and then a 20-hour review that takes place from Monday next week. It's Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday of next week. They're all over Zoom. If you're interested, just shoot me an email. These classes are not lectures. Basically, you're going to see a lot of scenarios because that's more realistic to your exams. So it's going to be lots of scenarios, lots of integrations. Then I have a bunch of diagrams that can really help to get home some very, very complex concepts for people. And then I have these podcasts on the major apps, Apple, Google, Spotify. I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLA podcasts and videos. And then, you know, check out my other website, DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Many people said, oh, wow, Divine, I love your life lessons. So I basically started a website, I think it was last year, where every week, for the most part, I put like two podcasts where from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. There's more than 200 episodes on there. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. But please check those out. Thank you for joining me today. Have a wonderful rest of your day. I'll see you in episode 487. So God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.